We're back with another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at the Federalist. As always, you can email the show at radio@thefederalist.com. Follow us on Twitter at FDRLST. Make sure to subscribe wherever you download your podcasts as well. Today, we're joined by Jacob Saul. He's a professor of philosophy, history, and accounting at the University of Southern California. Also the author of the new book. It's a fascinating new book called Free Market, The History of an Idea. That's out on September 6th. Jacob, welcome so much to the show.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
I just said welcome so much. I think it was a combination of welcome and thank you very much for joining the show. But nevertheless, I have many, many questions about this book, which I found just so compelling. I actually wanted to start with the endorsement that Larry Summers gave the book, where he says, "There's much to be learned relevant to current policy debates from Jacob Saul's engaging history of the free market idea." So based on that endorsement, I wanted to ask, were there any contemporary parallels as you were researching this epic, literally epic and rich history of free market philosophy? Were there any contemporary parallels that surprised you most?
Well, they're happening all the time. I mean, they're happening in all sorts of different ways. On one level, you're always amazed how the market will work on its own. The one, you can try something, and then a market mechanism will come in, and it will work. At the other level, we keep seeing the market breaking down, and we keep seeing these massive interventions by the state all over the world. But I think most of all, what really marked me was the sort of change in American attitudes over the past, I'd say 6 years or so, mm-hmm. 7 or 8 years, with the rise of China. And I think there was a lot of surprise that China emerged as a super rich country, because we had been told, I had been told, that you just couldn't get this rich unless you were really free. And unless you had a really free market. And China's proved that, I would say, in many respects, wrong. Not totally. We don't know what's going to happen yet, right? But that was the kind of giant paradigm shift for everybody, I think. And I think it's left a lot of people sort of in shock, because I don't think it was supposed to happen in that way. I don't know what other people think, but it definitely marked me.
That is really interesting. It's really, really interesting. Well, you get to China towards the end of the book, which is a great progression, because you talk a lot about Colbert and you talk about China sort of using the ideas of Colbert, but maybe it's best to go kind of chronologically. You actually start with Cicero. Can you tell us why you start with Cicero? You say, this is actually the first line of the book, "To understand the origins of free market thought, it is first necessary to understand Cicero's philosophy, which provided the idea that through aristocratic farming and moral behavior and politics, humans could tap into nature as an infinite and self-perpetuating source of wealth." Why start there with Cicero?
Well, I'm going to jump forward to tell you why I started there. I'm not trying to be, I'm not trying to say I've got all the answers, but I was trained as a historian of ideas, and I was trained in a pretty rough way. I mean, I went through a lot of schools in which we learned how to study the origins of ideas. I feel that economic historians have not done that work. And that's one reason you've never heard anyone say that. When one opens Adam Smith is an 18th century Ciceronian. Cicero permeates everything he does. He doesn't use footnotes, Adam Smith, but if you've read enough Cicero, you can be reading any one of his works. And there are many, many works, and they're all interrelated. And you can just see lines from Cicero left and right. That was something I kind of wanted to do in the book, but I think it would have been too hard, is just to show over and over again these sort of lines from Cicero. So if one were to say that Smith is the father of free market thought, and I think that's partially wrong. I don't think he thinks about free market thought in the way modern thinkers do. I think that's a grave error. I think we have to go back to the origins of Smith's thought. And it turns out there is a direct link, not only from Smith back to Cicero, but from every other free market thinker. It's every time I opened a book in the 18th century, in the 17th century, in the Middle Ages, in late antiquity, anyone talking about market exchange usually was reacting to or engaging with Cicero. So I didn't make this up. I just kept finding it. And it was, for a scholar, the kind of gift that keeps on giving, because you keep finding these things and you say, wow, I've hit a gold mine here. And so that's sort of how it happened.
And it's a very, and I don't mean this in a bad sense, it's very Western, very much a Western history. And I wonder if, starting with Cicero, what is Cicero drawing on, if anything, from other parts? I mean, certainly you could talk about Asia, you could talk about Africa, you could talk even about like South America. Is Cicero drawing on any of that more ancient history? Is there anything that kind of predates Cicero that it builds into what happened in Rome?
Well, that's a huge part. So you just made a really important point that I'd like to sort of touch on a whole bunch of ways. But just to get to your question, Cicero lived in a time when we didn't have the concept of East and West, because the Roman Empire spanned into the East. Cicero is drawing on extremely ancient ideas of aristocratic farming. They go into Greece, and I'm just trying to think about what I know about Mycenae and how those societies worked. But farming was the ideal, and the people who owned and tilled the land, depending on which society you were from, were usually extremely important. Some societies, priests were important, there were kings who were more important, but agriculture was the source of wealth. For Cicero, this, for him, he goes back to conservative Roman philosophy that supports the social system. Now remember, he's a parvenu. He was from the lower part of the nobility, and he's made it into the senatorial class. So he has the enthusiasm of the newcomer for this, the values of constancy. You know, once you make it, you want to hold on to it, right? And there's this idea that the Roman Republic, which is really old, I mean, the Roman Republic, when he's writing about it and it's collapsing, is more than 500 years old. That's a long time for a constitutional regime to sort of stand up in one way or another. And it stands up, you know, through the ruling class of these 200 senatorial families. And they base their wealth on these massive farm holdings around the Roman Republic, or what we now think of as the Roman Empire, but around the lands of the Roman Republic. Farming was the ideal. One little note, the joke is you didn't actually farm. If you're an aristocrat, you had people do it for you. But as all people like Cato and Varro say in their books on agriculture, the great Roman works on agriculture, and there are others, that you had to understand your farm. So you had to understand winemaking, you had to understand olives, you had to understand wheat. And so you could oversee your overseers. And it was that brought great virtue. Now that we could argue about that, but that was his vision. And therefore, you know, if you were a good farmer or a good farm owner, nature would sort of take its course. And the Roman Republic, which guaranteed the free seas on the Mediterranean and guaranteed a pax in all of its lands, made things look like they were working in a great sort of never-ending system, which I do think Cicero is idealizing, because at the time he's writing, it is in absolute collapse.
Hmm. And you, another really interesting part, I've been working really slowly through Dominion by Tom Holland, and it's a great kind of companion to what you're writing about in the early history of free market thought, because you're writing a lot about Christianity's effect on these concepts. And you write, in the early Christian economic system, good moral choices had to come from a sincere desire to trade worldly goods for a place in heaven. And then another quote from that section of the book I found interesting was, you said, such extreme voluntary sexual self-denial in exchange for salvation, definitely a part of the early church, made Christianity fundamentally more transactional than, say, Judaism. Why did these distinctions matter in the context of shaping free market thought?
Well, first of all, can I just connect Christianity to Cicero?
Yes.
I think it's so cool.
Yes.
And because I'm not a professional Latinist, I can't write the book that I want to write. I don't know if I should say it here. I don't know if I want to give it away. But I really do think that one way or another, and so I say this, you know, Cicero was deeply important for Christianity because he was a moral martyr. And he, even though he had done all these kinds of sort of hypocritical things, in the end, he died for his beliefs. And he is really famous. I mean, he is the sort of most read author the thought that emerges around Christianity after the death of Christ is Judeo-Greek, but it's in the Roman Empire. So Cicero has a place in all this. He is present in all these thinkings. Perhaps, I don't know if Christ is aware of somebody like Cicero, but other Christian thinkers definitely are. So when we get to the fathers of the church, Augustine, St. Augustine was a professor of rhetoric in Milan. That means he was a professional Ciceronian. St. Ambrose was brought up to be a member of the senatorial class. Well, the training in the fourth century was still Cicero. In fact, if you went to a bookstore in Rome, and yes, they still existed in the fourth century, you would find Cicero on the front shelves. He was the author of the time. What's so interesting to me is that the early fathers of the church were trying to fight against Cicero, but they were using Cicero. They were struggling with him. He was there the whole time. Now, Christianity is so interesting because Cicero really is opposed to individual desire, which is funny because we would think that would be a pagan idea. Cicero felt that anything you wanted should be out of love and disinterestedness, and I'm quoting him. And these are very Christian ideas, one would think, right? That's why he's so popular amongst Christian thinkers later on. And you only would exchange with people of your own class who were also disinterested. Of course, they weren't, but this is the ideal. But this idea that you would just want something, this is, I think, a sort of grand Christian insight into philosophy, that you have a specific desire. It could be carnal, it could be material. Mm-hmm. And what the fathers of the church say, and is that you have to actually just give that up in an exchange, in a mercantile spiritual exchange for treasure in heaven. They are very explicit about it. They say actually it is the translation from Greek from John of Chrysostom can be argued about. So we could say transaction, one could say a business transaction. The transitions people can argue about them, but they're generally clear. If you want to go to heaven, you will have to make a transaction based on your desires, trading not only your stuff, but even more importantly, your desire for the treasure of heaven. And that is a remarkable moment. If you do that, the system will then just work. And Augustine uses the term the invisible hand of God.
I was going to ask you about that.
It's amazing. There are all these histories of free market thought. I couldn't believe this stuff wasn't in there. I was like, this is too great. And this is just amazing.
So many Americans are looking for alternatives to the stock market and are looking to diversify their 401ks into more stable assets. It is considered prudent to place a portion of your retirement income into a precious metals IRA or to invest directly in gold or silver. There are many tax benefits associated with such an investment. Savvy investors know that gold has historically outperformed the stock market and helped the wealthy protect their assets through rough financial storms. Goldman Sachs analysts expect gold to rise to $2,500 by the end of 2022. Now is the time to protect your IRA with precious metals. Call the experts at Allegiance Gold, 844-790-9191. Allegiance Gold has been helping Americans protect their retirement and legacy for years. And when you call today, you'll get a bonus $500 in silver free for all qualifying accounts. Just mention this ad. Call 844-790-9191 today. That's Allegiance Gold, 844-790-9191, and get your $500 in silver today. Yeah, you quote Augustine saying, God's hand is his power, and God achieves even visible results by invisible means. And you say this was not yet Adam Smith's invisible economic hand, but it made clear that a higher power could regulate wealth. And it's very much connected, as it is in the Gospels, to not necessarily, there is money, but it's what money symbolizes, the human instinct, the gluttony, the greed that money symbolizes. And in some ways, I think you're arguing that this is a very important and in some ways novel restraint on human behavior that comes to inform the market philosophy.
Okay, yeah. I call this, well, I have several terms for this. I struggle with it and I think about it all the time. I call this the Garden of Eden problem, which I think Smith kind of solves for himself at least. But I also call it the Matthew problem, because Matthew says it all. He says, you know, you can't, you know, it's more, sorry, the quote is eluding me. You know, it's easier for a poor person to get into heaven, yeah, than a camel to go through the eye of a needle or something like that, or a rich man. Sorry, I'm messing up, right, the quote. But he also then goes on to make the Matthew parable that you have to invest your money well. I think people have not written about how confusing the Gospels of Matthew are. So I think that they're really hard. And I think they left Christianity with a double inheritance, which we've been struggling with ever since. That's something I believe to be a real issue. I want to just jump in though with, yeah, St. Augustine, who struggles with this too. And St. Augustine is the person who was a professor of rhetoric. He lived in a brothel. He had an unmarried wife and illegitimate children. And then he was a Ciceronian. He drank wine, right? He gives it all up. And he read Aristotle. And then he said that everyone else should give it up. And then he's appointed Bishop of Hippo, which is in North Africa, where you have all these different Christian and non-Christian sects, often violently fighting over theology. And he comes down. So you have, on the one level, Augustine saying you have to reject all wealth and all earthly things, all the knowledge of the ancients. But he's using the ancients to make that point. So it's very hard for him to escape his past, right? But at the other moment, he says, well, we're going to need good Christians to make some money so that they can pay for the church. Hmm. That's also a really tough one because, and this will go into medieval theology, well, how much money is that? And how much money do you have to give away? Most fathers of the church said you had to give it all away, all of it. St. Ambrose was an incredibly rich senator. I mean, he was a great, great earthly lord. He gave it all away. That's what you're supposed to do. I read so much theology for this book that I tend, from a theological standpoint, to go with the early Christian fathers that you have to give it all away and you have to give up everything to a certain extent. But I think they struggle with that idea too. How do we live on earth? I think these are huge questions.
Right. And in the context of Matthew, I mean, to me, I read that as just, it's a question of discipline, material discipline. And that's interesting the way that it kind of evolves with really early, with really early interpretations. And, you know, you write about Assisi, you write about St. Francis. We have Pope Francis right now who draws on St. Francis very directly. Because you say in many ways, the story of medieval economic thought begins with the life, yeah, of the founder of the Franciscan order. What importance is St. Francis to the evolution of free market thought?
St. Francis is so important that you could ask that about anything. I think he's a founding, you know, this is why many people in the church were upset with him. He was a kind of star, and he had followers. I mean, that in itself is, I was actually teaching this in class yesterday, that in itself is deeply problematic for certain Christian beliefs, that you have this charismatic leader leading his own kind of church. This is a church in which you have to vow total poverty. And the reason that Franciscans start coming up with early market analysis is because they need to price everything. They need to understand they can't own anything that is not beyond their absolute basic needs. So what happens if you own a book? Books were very expensive back then. Well, it has to be a book that is for a utilitarian purpose, in this case, a spiritual or perhaps legal purpose, right? But you can't own a book for pleasure. You could read a book for pleasure. St. Francis liked life, but you couldn't own it. And so the church was really opposed to this idea because they said, well, what if you miscalculate wealth and you own something? You've committed a mortal sin. You're going to hell forever due to a poor calculation. Now, I don't want to get into my own theological argument with that. But then again,
does hell exist? Let's just start with that.
Hell exist. Oh boy.
We could have so many discussions based on
certain. You know, I mean, I could give you a broad answer. I mean, it certainly seems so. These are all the biggest questions that we struggle with. But Francis's return to the true values. Sorry, I've got to really be careful. His return to the values of the early Christian fathers poses an enormous problem for the greatest property owner and tax collector in Europe, the Emperor of Rome, who has an army, who has palaces, and who is not at all unrealistic in saying we can't have a church without buildings and administration. Now, it depends what kind of church you want, right? But we can't have a large-scale European, or I don't even think they thought European, world church without an administration. And Francis says, no, we can't own anything. And in fact, we don't need a church. God's given us a church. It's nature. And that's some really radical stuff. But this fear of hell, this fear of damnation from ownership leads to the most sophisticated early market thought about market mechanisms. And one of the interesting things is the idea that labor and expertise and risk should go into valuation. I mean, most accountants don't put that onto balance sheets until very recently, and they're putting it onto moral balance sheets. So I would say I'm actually writing a new book about balance sheets, and spiritual accounting has most often been more sophisticated than financial accounting. That's a whole other story.
Oh, I love that. I can't wait to read that one too. So when I read Sapiens, which was like a massive bestseller, it really got me thinking about how technology has affected a lot of this. And you write about, I don't know how to pronounce it, Levy. You say it was the first thinker, this is 900 years before Karl Marx, Levy was the first thinker to discuss the market concept of capital. And this follows after you're talking about St. Francis. And I wonder how much of that, if you could tell us a little bit about him, and also perhaps how the evolution, as we're getting into the medieval era and then into the Enlightenment and ultimately where we are now, how does the kind of snowballing of technological innovation also kind of start the ball rolling further down the hill with market thought?
Well, that's a really complicated question. I hope that's a hard question you just posed me there. Well, first of all, sorry, I don't have it in front. It's Jean-Pierre Olivier. Jean-Pierre Olivier is a provincial, so he's from Provence, a cleric from Montpellier. And he is a Franciscan who is struggling with this idea of damnation and value and ownership. And he he writes these amazing books about contract law, for example. And in them, you have to be very careful what you agree to in a contract as a Franciscan, or you can go to hell. But he comes out with this concept of what is capital and how is capital used. And it's a very explicit use of the word. I think he uses the word capital, and it's pretty remarkable. But the point is, he doesn't just use it like that. He uses it from a series of reasonings about investing and about ownership. He loses his possibility to have a professorship in Paris. A lot of these guys do because of the Dominicans and, you know, St. Francis and other people like that who are just horrified by these Franciscans. So he's deemed as heretical at a certain point for various really complex theological ideas. But this is one reason that he is, you know, he sees capital as existing and as something that grows and moves. It's really interesting. And as taking all sorts of different forms, I mean, he really references the capital of expertise as well. I find that to be just absolutely remarkable. I mean, and my new book actually might just take up a lot of this old stuff that I've already talked about. It's just so interesting. It just has never been discussed by anybody. I mean, it's been discussed by an Italian colleague, but for example, here in the United States, no one's really taken it up. That's just, it's really, really remarkable. And the church is really concerned about this because the church is sitting on all this capital. And if you even start, you also have earthly lords who don't want to pay, don't want to give up. They don't necessarily pay taxes, but some of their tax base goes to the church. They don't want that to happen. So the church is in a long-term struggle with earthly rulers about who gets what. And if the Franciscans say, look, this is capital and how it works, and it really shouldn't concern the church. I mean, they get to the point where they say, the church can't understand capital. They have no idea of how to evaluate something because they don't understand labor, risk, the price of goods. I mean, by saying that, you undermine the possibility of the church morally owning goods. I mean, it's really threatening, really radical stuff. I think that's pretty amazing. You know,
No, I was going to say, it reminds me actually of a line in Yoram Hazzoni's new book on conservatism, where he says it essentially has privatized virtue. And it almost sounds as though that's an alarm bell that's ringing with Franciscans.
What has privatized virtue?
That our market ideology has privatized virtue in different ways. And it does almost sound like that's what the concern was, centuries ago.
The history of virtue, I taught this yesterday. I can't believe you're bringing this up. It's kind of amazing. The history of virtue is long and winding. Virtue does not mean what it meant. I mean, my grandmother's 103. She's from Germany. What she thinks of virtue is definitely not what I think of virtue. I mean, she is much more puritanical than I am, and much more disciplined than I am. I'm not saying I don't work hard, but materially, my grandmother is remarkably disciplined. I mean, I don't know people that disciplined these days. I do, but not necessarily around me. Well, virtue's hard though. And I think the Franciscans would have said that there are earthly virtues. And the Franciscans moved away from Augustine a bit. And they said, look, you know, these merchants have the virtue of knowing when to spend money, how to spend money, and how to take risk. And we can't get into that. That is Caesar's realm. They say that. I think William of Ockham, who is, to every listener, go back and read William of Ockham. What a genius. I mean, you don't have to agree with him, but also you can have the illusion that you're reading a modern writer, and he's not. Mm. But wow, he is such a brilliant guy. And I think it's he who writes that essentially there is this whole realm of Caesar, and that the church just has no place there. The church has to stick to spirituality, and these material questions and these political questions are not for the church. And that too is a great threat.
How does Machiavelli affect the way people think about markets? You have and this is again a huge question because you have a very long analysis that folks should read in the book of Machiavelli. You start with an epigraph where he said, well-ordered republics have to keep the public rich, but the citizens poor. What is his impact?
Well, he didn't mean poor. It was a sort of turn of speech. He meant poorer than the state. Hmm. Machiavelli's tough. Most people, by the way, think of Machiavelli as a sort of promoter of evil. He is kind of the opposite. You might want to look at him in many ways as a kind of neo-Augustinian, where he says, look, we're damned. I mean, we're on earth. We have bitten into the forbidden apple. We're in real trouble. I mean, we're humans. The whole point, right? You know that labor was considered by most theologians to be our punishment, work. And therefore, the people who were doing commerce were seen as paupers, by the way. That's what Olivi thought, that no one who worked for money as their goal, that would be make you the poorest thing in the world. So the greatest paupers were merchants. That's, by the way, an old Franciscan, and it's an idea of Olivi. Doesn't mean you shouldn't work with them. Doesn't mean they don't exist, but they are great spiritual paupers because they're not focused on the other things, which are spirituality before all. Machiavelli wants republics. He believes, as does Cicero, and he's based his work on Cicero and Livy and these Romans who believe that the stability of the state brings wealth and peace on earth, and very arguably a possibility for a more healthy spirituality. Depends on your beliefs, but this is, I believe, what he's talking about. If the state allows oligarchs to take over, as they did in Florence, you get civil war. And this is happening all around Italy in the Middle Ages and the Renaissance, that you have powerful citizens trying to take the state over. That's Romeo and Juliet, right? I mean, that's the old cliched story. You have these fighting clans. If you have these clans that get too rich, they can destabilize the state. They can become dictators. And he says that dictators are bad for the market because you don't have an open exchange system. Mm-hmm. And they can undermine the wealth of the general populace. Therefore, when he says that, you need a state, and the Florentine state is remarkably open and has early democratic processes and principles. It's quite extraordinary. It's not what we would think today, but for the time, it is quite remarkable that common people could join the state, work for the state, and take part in voting. And it was supposed to be a private process, a secret process of voting. The Medici family corrupted it, but that's who he's talking about. You don't want a family like the Medici to become richer than the state. They destabilize it. They create monopolies. They destabilize a market where there's competition. That is part of what he's saying, and it's quite remarkable. So this is a problem that we're still stuck with today, right? This is the Machiavelli problem. No one wants a state, but economies don't seem to work well without good states. What's a good state? Well, Machiavelli says it's a state that can oversee its citizens, which its citizens can't overtake and control.
You have a chapter. Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. A single citizen. He doesn't want one person, a dictator or an oligarch, to take over. And he calls them optimates.
You have a chapter with the wonderful title, England's Free Trade by Means of the State, which I loved, and has some really helpful stuff about both the Dutch and the British East India companies, which really, to me, also are kind of inextricably intertwined with the technology that was facilitating much easier globalization. You know, Rome, of course, stretched into Asia, but what was happening then was something new entirely. Could you talk about the similarities and differences in the Dutch and British East India companies, kind of how they learned from each other or didn't, and basically how they operated?
Well, that's a huge, okay, let's just take 3 days here.
Yeah.
that's a big question. These are colonial trading companies. They're based on a Dutch model, more or less, which comes out from looking at the Spanish and Portuguese empires and saying that they are sort of inefficient in a mercantile way. They were essentially raiding. So you get the massive power of the Spanish and the Portuguese creating this incredible planetary empire. But they're not very good at taking its raw materials and using its labor. And so the Dutch are more efficient. So they create a company that does this. There are stories about, you know, a shipment of wood from the Amazon, as usual, coming to the coast, and the Spanish are waiting for it and never arrives. The Dutch had set up a comptoir, a trading counter. They had already set up their wagons. They had gotten the wood. They had already sent it to Antwerp by the time the Spanish were waiting for it. So it was sort of parasitic initially. So the Dutch don't create a massive empire like the English and the French will do later on the basis of the Spanish and Portuguese. The technology initially is a Portuguese kind of boat, which has a low keel, which allows for deep water, long distance travel. You also have the astrolabe, you have navigation, and then you have double entry accounting, accrual accounting, which allows you to have multi-partner firms, much more sophisticated kinds of capital investment. So those are the technologies which start this whole thing. And of course, they all do start start partially in Italy, move briefly to Portugal and Spain, and then are taken up with great force by the English, by the Dutch, the English, and the French. As far as what makes them different, well, this I think is really interesting, because both the Dutch and the English are going to start using the term free trade. Mm-hmm. The French will use it too, actually. I mean, the French, they're all working, they're all competing and working together. By the way, I say that you can't study one, you can't study the three, or you can't study one without studying the three. They're too intertwined. And you, then you're also going to need to know Portugal and Spain. You really just have to, because it's so intertwined. And in particular, in the end, it really is the French and the English are going to emerge fighting each other for 150 years and evolving through the fighting over these imperial companies and these empires. And we've studied the English sort of as a standalone. You just can't do that. It's not the way they thought about themselves. But one of the things I do think we have to realize is that a lot of the free trade thought, whether it be from Hugo Grotius or by these early English thinkers that say we need free trade by the state. I mean, that's a quotation. It's not me saying that. What they're really saying is we need freedom of the seas for the most dominant. And that is not necessarily a friendly thing. The Dutch are trying to raid other people's empires. Mm. And they're trying to also raid indigenous people's wealth. And they want a law that will help them do it. They're the best at it. So this is a very, this, the ideas that Grotius is puts forward are the ideas demanded of him by the Dutch East India Company. Mm. Okay. When we get to the early 17th century and you have thinkers like Thomas Mann and Edward Mistleton, who I love because their books are called free trade. They use the word free trade. And then they go on to discuss some market mechanisms and the great need for the state to be involved and oversee infant industries and use tariffs to allow them, the English, to trade freely, because without the state protecting them, the Dutch are too powerful. They'll just overwhelm all their markets. Hmm. So we might see that as a paradox right now in America, where we have been so economically dominant, although right now we don't necessarily feel that way, do we? Many people. So, but the early thinkers who I'm looking now at the books on my shelf, all of them call them early mercantilist thinkers or complex economic thinkers. I'm like, no, these were the pioneering free market thinkers. These guys understood, and Colbert is exactly one of these guys. He's saying the same thing they do, the French minister of Louis XIV. We need to develop our infant industries, our shipping and our wool. Let's just, there are other industries too. But shipping and wool really are the ones that have to be developed. We have to develop them with some protection and aid so that we can compete, first of all, with the Dutch, who are so far ahead of everybody mm-hmm. else. And remember that in 1651 and 1660, the English write the navigation laws. And those are laws to protect the English shipping companies, essentially to protect the British Empire. Mm-hmm. What will become the British Empire. So, and when many English and British people are talking about free trade, they're actually talking about a free trade imperial zone that they control with a military and protectionism. So, I mean, it's, we keep getting back to conditions and paradoxes. And I think that's the idea of some pure idea of free market thought. I've just never found it functioning. It's a beautiful idea, but, and I like freedoms, believe me, and I like economic freedoms. But aside from what I believe, what history shows us is this constant conditionality, this constant funny situations and paradoxes.
And as technology progresses, you actually talk about Copernicus and Galileo. We get into the Enlightenment period, and you talk about Locke and Rousseau. And this is what you wrote about Locke. Drawing on a mix of Ciceronian and Christian inspiration, he explained that private property was the linchpin of both political liberty and a functioning market. Adam's fall from the Garden of Eden, where all things were shared in common, created the need for private property and human labor. And you talk about Enlightenment economics, and that is such a that particular description of Locke, I think, is so helpful, because you have this gradual weakening of monarchies. And as the economies of more Republican forms of government come along with the philosophies of more Republican forms of government, those economic models change a little bit. So can you tell us, not just a little bit, that's a wild understatement. Can you tell us about what happened with Enlightenment economics? What's the big transition there?
Well, there are a whole bunch, but it's another great, really hard question. And thank you for reading my book so closely, because you're hitting all the key points. By the way, I love the Locke stuff. Nobody reads both treatises by Locke. The first treatise is all about Adam and Eve. It's a biblical text. The second one is this kind of what we would think of as a standard political text. That's why everybody assigns it. And I'm looking at my shelves again. I've got all the editions of Locke's second treatise, the ones that we would get in college. What about the first treatise? Well, I had not read the first treatise, believe it or not. I'll admit that, until 8 years ago. And when I read it, I was like, what? This is like a crazy biblical text about Adam and Eve and about the punishment of labor, because that's our punishment. So we have, and this gets back to Matthew, we have to make it efficient. He's this great believer in efficiency. But he's also a strange guy. This is the guy who works for the Stuart monarchy, which has absolutist pretensions. And he writes, the Constitutions of Maryland, which is a monarchist feudal slavery text. It's one of like the most kind of awful texts ever written. Mm. I mean, it backs up the idea of absolute monarchy. It backs the idea of feudal lords with titles, and it backs up the idea of slavery. All things which I think have been very troublesome for our country. Okay. And they're all in our DNA, because Locke was there when he was making the country, literally, with these absolutist monarchs. He put those laws in there, which have affected us since then, right? But then he is appalled by monarchy. And with his more noble patrons, he wants a freer monarchy, which eventually is something that will emerge. And he wants a monarchy based on Roman Republican principles and parliamentary principles. But it's also based on another idea for free markets, which I don't think people realize with Locke. It's that you can only have private property if you are going to farm it and do commerce. He does not believe that people who don't farm. So he believes that the indigenous peoples, he gives thought to the indigenous peoples of the Americas. And he talks about their wealth, and he talks about how they don't do anything with it. This is one of the old, this is the John Wayne principle. John Wayne used this to say, look, you know, killing off American indigenous peoples is not an issue. They were just not productive enough. That's kind of crazy that I don't think John Wayne knew that he was paraphrasing an idea in Locke. I don't think Locke believed in killing anybody off, though. That's for sure. But he believed, I don't know if it's for sure, but I have not seen that. Also, Locke comes around in his second treatise and says slavery is bad, but he doesn't say what to do with it. That's another big problem. I've always been kind of angry at him for that, because I feel like he could have solved a lot of problems, and I don't think he wanted to wade into it. So he wanted to say, look, slavery is a terrible thing, period.
You know? I think that was true of a lot of the sort of Enlightenment thinkers of the time. They had this instinctive reaction to it as being bad, and then they never wanted to touch the solutions.
Smith didn't. Smith liked it. Smith thought it could be nicer. And Smith thought people could evolve. And he says that of the more primitive European American settlers. And he makes a kind of point that if we're nicer to slaves, then we won't have to enslave them in the same way. But that's sort of all he says.
Lovely.
So Smith doesn't get off as well as others do. I mean, Locke comes off and says, this is really wrong. But what Locke, this is something, and I work with my friend Jeffrey Collins, who's a brilliant guy, and I actually have his book on Locke over here that I want to plug. And I think it's called In the Shadow of Leviathan. I think that's his book. Hold on. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to just see, because it's really an important book. Jeffrey R. Collins, In the Shadow of Leviathan, John Locke and the Politics of Conscience. Collins is a really great expert on Locke, and we had many discussions about Locke. He helped me with the Locke chapter, because Locke is really hard. And he was the one that brought me to a close reading of the text and of other texts in which he said, look, Locke believes in a strong state. Most parliamentarians do. They just believe it has to be elected and it has to follow the laws. But once that state is there, he says that it appears that Locke doesn't just believe you can take land away from indigenous people who are not farming and using the land in the way that Locke thought we had to as our punishment from God. And they're almost living too well, indigenous people, right? They weren't living the punishment of labor, which then becomes a virtue. It's very complex in Christian thought. People need to dig into that.
Like Weber and the German sense of virtue, as we were just talking about.
Right, these senses of virtue, which are really complex, though. But he also says something else, that Locke believed that if you also weren't using your land as a European in an efficient way, that the state could take it from you too. And so I think we have a lot of struggling to do with Locke, simply because not because we're dumb or something like that, and not because it's just there's so much out there, but I think we get these mythologies and simplistic readings that we really like, just like the readings we have, for example, of Adam Smith or free market thought. And we want to run with them because it turns out that we have not done the work necessary to understand them, that we just haven't put them in a deep enough context. We haven't read all the works around them. And that's what scholars are doing now. This is why we have to fund our humanities and fund our universities. We're just beginning the voyage of learning. It's just begun. It's pretty recent. And so, we're figuring out Locke, and lots of texts have emerged, for example, about slavery, about the constitutions of Maryland, but also about what Locke thinks about property and what it means to have a parliamentary regime for Locke.
They just eminent domained a Wendy's in my neighborhood, and I think I'm going to blame Locke for that. The Wendy's wasn't productive enough. But actually, you brought up Adam Smith, and I was going to, of course, ask you. Go ahead.
Well, actually, I just wanted to note that eminent domain is usually used in really poor neighborhoods, and that just is an old idea. So I was shocked that they would touch Wendy's because it's a powerful, wealthy company. And I'm sure Wendy's didn't lose. They have too many lawyers, you know, so I'm sure they found a way with that. But if you're just the owner of a house and someone wants to make a baseball stadium or, I don't know, a road, you might be in trouble. I can tell you it's not going to happen if you have a lot of dough.
It's interesting because it's tied to what you're talking about in terms of productivity, and it's the same thing we saw with voting rights in early America and coming out of people like Locke, the idea of property and productivity. And Adam Smith is another person who is completely grossly misinterpreted by different camps. He's sort of been projected onto, but you cite specifically Hayek and Friedman for misinterpreting, or I think cherry picking is the word that you use when it comes to Adam Smith, who's a very, very, very complicated figure. And from those Hayekian interpretations, then I think that association of him being in defense of greed and, you know, naked capitalism comes. What do people really get wrong about Smith?
Well, first, I just want to recommend everyone to get the original version, to read the original version of Smith's Wealth of Nations from the Liberty Foundation, because they have the accurate version. It is around 1,200 huge, dense pages. It is a hard read. I spent years reading it, okay? Years. You have to read his Moral Sentiments book as well. There is no way to understand it without understanding his moral philosophy. And also, it's very, very hard because of the context he wrote it in. He expected everyone to share his education, his belief. So the people in Glasgow and Britain at the time, the elite, were reading Cicero. They were reading Locke. And so when you get to his lectures on jurisprudence and his lectures on the Beaux-Arts and all these other things, he has all these lectures, which he kind of just expected any literate person to know. He makes it very clear that he's a Lockean. He makes it very clear he's a Ciceronian. And as you go into the Wealth of Nations, it's much easier to read it if you read it as he had sort of intended it to be read, as part of this bigger superstructure. That said, even reading it alone, I think most people interpret it in crazy ways because it's a massive book, which seems self-contradictory because it's from a very different age. Smith, well, we have to just be, Smith was himself from a family of lower, a lower end of the nobility of landowners. Okay. So he's a landowner and a professor. He is an Enlightenment philosopher. He is, his mentor is David Hume. Hume is an atheist. Hume can't get a job at the university because of this. We think Smith might have been some kind of atheist because he never pronounced, he doesn't mention Christianity in his work. It's kind of a big oversight in, I don't know, the thousands and thousands of pages. I'm like, okay, come on, where, you know, he talks about, he'll mention it here and there, but doesn't go into it. He talks about Newton. He talks about deism, the idea of a great architect. So there's an architect of nature, and that architect just creates nature. But he is a Stoic, Ciceronian Stoic. And that means that our moral capacity is in our secular hands. And it comes from discipline. It comes from learning. It comes from knowing the law and philosophy and from discussion. So it is a learned moral capacity that, that humans have, but not all humans can have it because it takes so much work. And he's very clear on that. He calls, he takes this from Epictetus, the idea of the disinterested observer, someone who can observe things and not become emotional about them and make these good decisions that are not based on passion. And so Smith believes that an ideal society is in the society of landowners who do not, were not involved with the mercantile trades, because he says that they always lead to monopoly and greed, that they have to be these parliamentarian leaders as they were at the time. All of his patrons were the great Scottish lords who were enormously powerful in parliament. And he told them, and they were his patrons, that they were the ones, and he was teaching their children moral philosophy, and he was getting paid well for it. So this was also his job, that I will teach you the moral philosophy you need to make these laws, and it's very hard to make laws. He's always just saying, look, we try and make laws, they don't work as we intend, but the best people to make them are these disinterested landowners, because not only are they disinterested, but they follow the logic of nature, which is not necessarily greed. And he's very opposed to companies, which he sees as taking away the labor of the working man, which he says. Just read him. I mean, this isn't my interpretation. He's very opposed to merchants, who he says are mercantile and almost always seek their own wealth over the common good and the wealth of the nation. And that's in the Invisible Hand passage where he said, and then there we have lower merchants like the bookers, butchers and the bakers, right? And they, he said, are just going to have their daily interests in mind. We need society and this moral society, this invisible hand, to bring people back to agriculture and bring people underneath this parliamentary agricultural regime so they'll invest in agriculture and enrich the country in a healthy, moral way.
And you get to, logically, of course, you get to, and chronologically, you get to Rand and Friedman. And what's interesting to me is they're reacting in some sense to Engels and Marx, and in some sense, yeah, Rand to Nietzsche. And what's, I'm wondering is, because then you have this concept of the rugged individualism, as you write, 20th century orthodox free market economics believed that pure individual desire and agency were the catalyst for all societal and economic good. And to me, a sort of 21st century conservative, what jumps out is the question of how the postmodern departure that came on the heels of the Enlightenment, and Patrick Deneen has written about this, comes on the heels of the Enlightenment, and people suddenly stop believing in the absolute truth of Christianity in the West and in the absolute truth of religion and in the absolute truth of a lot of different things. How does postmodernism actually, in a weird way, maybe shape, because you also write about the influence of Christianity or of free market economics on Christianity. You talk about how some of the televangelists of the age were coming together with, some of the rugged individualist writers, and you get into Goldwater and all of that. But is postmodernism something that really starts shaping, especially American economics?
Okay, well, I'm going to be, I know what you mean by postmodernism, and I have to say that, well, there were some brilliant people involved with it. it was a train wreck. I mean, I do think that there are truths that are formulated by context and power and all these things, but I do think we can find moral truths. I mean, I think it's hard, but I think we can do it, right?
Right.
And I think that that's one of the things that really hurt the humanities. I think we're still living with that today, and it was deeply upsetting for those of us who went through it. That doesn't mean there weren't brilliant insights. I think someone like Michel Foucault really is a brilliant person that everyone should read, and you don't have to agree with him, but I do think you should read him. Derrida, you know, these guys, obviously a brilliant guy, but like, I don't even want to go there. But I just wanted to say, I think, isn't Adam Smith kind of postmodern? I mean, he's already he's already, he's not postmodern. He's kind of post-Christian in a lot of ways. I mean, mm-hmm. I don't think that he was a Christian. I think that he was a deist.
Yeah.
And I think that he was probably a Newtonian. Now, Newton was a Newtonian Christian evangelical deist. People need to study what that means. It's pretty crazy. Okay. It's like not what Christianity, there's a before and after for Christianity. By the way, the Baptists are sitting looking at Isaac Newton saying, no way. And they flee to the United States because they want a medieval form of Christianity without science. Anglicanism takes on science, and so do other forms of Protestantism, some forms of Protestantism, very American forms. Ben Franklin's another deist, very complicated. Joseph Priestley. They don't believe in an organized church at all. They don't believe in priests, or having any kind of spiritual leader. It's all individual. And it's also really rough. You have to constantly judge yourself. I write about that actually in my last book on accounting. It's super interesting about the dissenters in England. I think they're a group that really worth everybody knowing about. They're just so interesting. And they created the Industrial Revolution. So I think we do have to know about them. But to get back to your question, I don't think that postmodernism affected that many Americans. I think it happened in universities, and I think that not that many people, even in universities, believed all of postmodernism. I think it had a great force at the time when everyone was an English major, and you had it coming into English and French in particular, and so it was kind of radical. It then led in many. I could get in trouble for saying this stuff. I just don't want to anger people. I don't want to simplify things in an insulting way. But I think it really hurt the fact that we have very few English and French majors now. We have almost none. Okay. Right. I think Yale has like two or four French majors or something like some very low number. All right. That's a tragedy. I mean, people all used to study French. They all used to study English. I think that postmodernism hurt that, and that we could discuss why and what was good and what was bad, but I think that was by not sort of owning and saying, look, these texts are important and they do have meaning and we should read Shakespeare. And I think that was a great error, but that's, some people are going to think I'm reactionary for that. I'm not. I believe that Shakespeare's for everybody. But I think when we get to people like Hayek and Friedman, I see them more as products of what happened at the beginning of the 20th century with Nazism and totalitarian communism. I don't think communism has ever existed. Nazism, definitely, they gave it a good go, okay? And I tell my students, the one moral thing you'll get from me in class is Nazis are really bad, okay? Like, don't forget that. The Nazis are really, really bad. The communists were filled with idealists following neo-Christian values in many ways, and they just fell into terrible totalitarianism, a disaster, scary disaster. It's killed many, 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 many people. I think someone like Hayek and the German-speaking sort of modern free market thinkers were coming from aristocratic backgrounds, really still connected to the idea of agriculture and physiocracy and the thought that inspired Adam Smith, that there was this free market that could be led by a certain elite. So for the early free market thinkers, it was aristocratic landowners, same for Smith. So you had a kind of chosen economic group that weren't necessarily more efficient, but they were more virtuous by their very existence of owning farms, for example. Their free market thought comes from that, but I think it really then gets inspired by modern thought about Superman, right? The super agents of Ayn Rand.
Yes.
And I don't think that Ayn Rand is a serious thinker. People read Ayn Rand, and every person I run into, all these people like, Ayn Rand's my favorite author. I'm like, wow, I'm sorry. Like, can I order you some Shakespeare? You know, can I give you some Charles Dickens, some Balzac? I mean, really, seriously, I'm just like, there are these great authors out there. And Rand is a kind of comic book author, and the characters are, they remind me of, you know, remember, we do have Superman too. We have Batman.
Yeah.
And we have Ayn Rand's characters. I kind of like Superman because the old Superman, I like the early Superman. I was a big Superman collector and fan as a kid. I believed in the whole thing. I liked it. But there are all sorts of arguments we could have about what Superman means, where it comes from. It's all very interesting. But I think that Friedman and Hayek, I think in the case of someone like Hayek, he's traumatized by the war, rightfully so. He's traumatized by communism. He's traumatized by Nazism. Who wouldn't be? Okay. And he's horrified by this state. And he also comes out of a tradition of the Austro. A lot of them come out of the Austro-Hungarian tradition, where there is a lot of aristocratic displeasure at the more tolerant, modern, monarchical, failing Austro-Hungarian state. By the way, we don't teach that in American universities either. Every American should know about the Austro-Hungarian Empire. We are partially the product of it, and we are the new iteration of it, of a multi-ethnic, multi-religious, multicultural empire trying to hold together. We just are. We look, if you want to understand our problems and what might await us and how to get over them, we really do need to understand the Austro-Hungarian Empire. So they're coming out of these specific things, and they take these kind of extreme views. The state is always bad. Friedman's idea, taxation is always theft. There's just no historical entity ever that existed that did anything without taxation.
It's kind of a Marxist argument about labor, but that's anyway.
Well, I mean, but this goes back to St. Augustine. Right. These guys who are trying to escape something and end up being of it themselves. By the way, Marx has a lot of free market thought in him. This
Absolutely.
Idea that things can work on.
And he was very concerned about globalization. He was very concerned about the effect of capitalism on morality. Marx is very misunderstood.
I mean, think about Marx as a Jew who kind of becomes Christianized, who then becomes a communist thinker. Mm-hmm. I mean, these guys are really, they're caught up in all of these imperial and ancient traditions that they're fighting. This is what happened with China too. You fight the, you know, you get the Chinese communists fighting the empire, and they just recreate the Chinese empire minus the cultural sophistication. Seriously, I mean, this is when you do that, when you make a revolutionary break, you usually fall right back into what you're trying to escape. That's something I see in history. That's why I'm like, really be careful of revolutionary breaks. You usually are getting what you're saying you're fighting against. That is, I think, an old form of conservatism in which you move slowly by tradition and by the knowledge that you have, and you don't destroy these institutions that we've built because they have been very carefully built and they're very fragile, and we have to be very careful with them. And if we want to reform them, that's also hard work. I believe that is a more Burkean
way of looking at things.
Yeah. I don't feel like a Burkean, but I am. I mean, I'm not in a lot of ways, but I am in others. I'm just like, for example, take the modern university. Everybody's down on it. I'm off it down. And I go in the classroom. We do great things every day. That's why people come from all over the world to come to our universities. Do you think that the wealthiest people in the country, some of them are sending their kids to American universities to get the etiquette to be rich? Okay. It doesn't always work that way. A lot of them is because their kids want to do it because it's a wonderful experience. And do we have ideologues in classrooms? Sure, but the kids are smart enough. They can usually think their way. Or this idea that kids are being indoctrinated, have you dealt with any kids? I mean, they're usually pretty smart. And I've got two daughters, and I don't, you know, what they tell me is, we don't want to, you know, they tell me to shut up in politer terms, you know. They have their own ideas. And if I try and tell them an idea, the same thing with my students, they're just going to be like, who is this clown? So the Socratic tradition is alive and well in America. Does it tilt one way in a lot of classrooms? Sure. But do the students buy all that? Not necessarily. So, and by the way, most students are business majors now, and business schools are pretty conservative. Okay. So I don't think there's a problem that people see. I think these are old institutions. I think they're ancient institutions. I think that the idea of destroying them and giving up on them is absolute madness. We've been working on them not only since ancient Greece, but really since for the last 800 years. I mean, when I went to Cambridge University, I could see the original building was the Pythagoras building. I could see it from my window. It was behind St. John's College, and I went to Magdalen College. 800-year-old thing. And when I went to Cambridge, a lot of Cambridge had not changed yet. And that was bad in some ways, but it was still a place where you learned a lot, and there was a lot of brilliance and a lot of intellectual and innovative wealth, even coming out of a conservative institution, right? You could create things. Sorry, I'm kind of raving now on this idea of taking things apart. And that's what I don't like. I think we have to be more careful. I think we can't attack institutions in the same way. And I think if we're going to talk about taxation, that's how we started. I think this rant started.
Right.
Adam Smith criticizes it. Of course, he ends up a tax collector. And he believes in tax collection. He just believes it should be done well. He believes, by the way, every American should read Alexander Hamilton's Project on Manufactures. I think it's one of the best, most, and I don't talk about it enough in the book because when I was writing those chapters, I'll admit I was too rushed and I left him behind, and I've been rereading it, and it is so brilliant in its understanding of market functions. But there's this idea that you tax and you figure out how much you can tax without undermining business, but you should tax. And in certain cases, you have to take the tax money and flow it to certain infant industries that can't get off the ground. I mean, how do you think Tesla got begun? Tesla was begun with federal government loans.
Yeah.
Now, people are criticizing Tesla, and I'm not buying a Tesla anytime soon. They look dangerous to me. I eventually want an electric car, but Tesla's this massive world entity, a measure of success. And Elon Musk is talking about not paying taxes. It's a guy who got his start with tax and federal money. We're stuck with this problem that the book begins with. We're in this relationship with free market thought where we say the state is terrible. We need a totally free market. And the people who say that is someone like Elon Musk, who's gotten rich on perhaps by his own skill, but definitely with government funds.
Right.
So I don't know, chew that up and tell me what to think.
And, you know, we could go into Keynes and China. I mean, speaking of Elon Musk, we could talk about China. We could talk about a lot of that. I could keep going all day. But to you know, be respectful of your time, I was thinking this is kind of a full circle question, because earlier when you said a parallel that stuck out to you was some of the questions that have been raised about free markets recently. And it reminded me actually of a quote that I looked up from the book, where you are writing about the collapse of the Roman Empire in the 400s. And you say, "With the fall of the empire went the idea of an overarching natural economic system. When effective human government collapsed, nature suddenly seemed less harmonious and nurturing. And the idea that the economy was self-regulating and generous no longer made sense." And if I can sort of for a moment try to take myself out of the body of a 21st century conservative and analyze it, you know, from a distance, maybe from the left or the center, and look at what's happening in conservatism, look what's happening even with the sort of neoliberal approach to free markets in general, is there a parallel to that skepticism that crept into Rome when they suddenly realized the economy of the idea of the economy being self-regulating and generous doesn't make sense anymore as the as an empire collapses?
Well, I mean, think about it for a second. I mean, I think I give some detail, but I mean, people start dying all over the place. They start getting rickets. Their lifespan shortened. They're hungry. All the industries fall apart. I mean, like, we have these, we keep finding these collapsed pottery industries. Mm-hmm. There's a famous book on this by a guy named McCormick who just talks about the collapse, the economic collapse of the Roman Empire. I mean, it's like epically horrific what happens. Lots of people die because this economy falls apart. When we emerge in Western Europe, and I say this we because that's where my family's from, and that's the tradition that I'm really familiar with and the history that I know. When we emerge there, there's nothing there. And you have all these churchmen going, uh-oh, I mean, we just got chaos here. There's not enough food. There's no state. The church is going to have to become a state, and it's going to have to become pretty authoritarian. And we're going to make a lot of decisions for everybody. And first of all, we've got all these slaves, and we're going to use them. I mean, the church is, until the year 1000, everybody's a slave except a few people.
Right.
And so they become the great feudal lords. By the way, wine, cheese, all these wonderful European inventions are done by these monasteries with the slaves bringing in all these goods. Well, guess what? These goods are very scarce. Not like scarcity today. There was plenty, but it was hard to take from these massive forests, right? You didn't have great farms and systems and roads and small factories to deal with agriculture in the early Middle Ages. So you had a kind of scarcity. You didn't have communication system. And so everything had to be managed and ordered. And you only really have the moment of free merchants sort of emerging in around the 1100s, the moment of the end of slavery and the rise of the merchant republics in Italy. But for hundreds of years in Europe, you have a heavily authoritarian regime of churches and then kings overseeing all economic activity, because if they didn't, there would have just been chaos. So you build walls, you make rules, and you develop your economy. When that economy develops more, you land in the central Middle Ages, where the merchant emerges again. And suddenly we have the Franciscans are a direct reaction to the emergence of the merchant. You didn't need priests to preach absolute poverty when most people were absolutely poor. Sorry, it's not actually funny, but it just, people don't really point that out either.
Right.
But I think that's really interesting. So, yeah, I mean, look, China was, when Mao died, which I mean, Mao left the country, China was a giant feudal country, feudal. Like, people were semi-owned by great lords, by great overlords, agricultural overlords. China was just made up of peasants that scraped the ground, earth. When Mao died, it was the same way. Mao had just made the country even poorer. He had caused famines. Mao was a disaster. Like Stalin was a disaster. He just killed a lot of people. And Mao, yeah, I don't even get into Mao. But then you have the Chinese leadership afterwards, and they are sort of more from an old Chinese imperial tradition where they're like, okay, we have this huge country to manage. What are we going to do? And guess what they do? They start calling in free market economists. Not because they're going to free their market, because they want to understand efficiency in production. And they're like, these guys have something. They definitely understand these market mechanisms that we can learn from. I think this already started in the 1930s, that there was an enormous amount of exchange. My colleague and friend Isabella Weber has written a book about this, or she wrote also an article about the early arrival of free market economists in China, a long history of interaction. And one of the places where you get free market thinkers having an outsized role has always been in China. They just don't think that it's going to be total. They think that you're going to have efficiencies and mechanisms, and the state is going to oversee it, let some people be freer or not. I'm not saying this is the way to go or the only way to go, but it was remarkable if you look at where China was 30 years ago in absolute poverty, or 40 years ago, to being in many ways by measure the richest country on earth.
It's amazing.
It's something we need to think about, you know. So,
absolutely.
I just One note, I was giving a talk to a whole bunch of business leaders, and one business leader raised his hand. And these are people I admire a lot, all right? And he said, well, we know that the state has never done anything good or produced anything of any value. I was just up on this stage, and I had my hosts, and you know, I didn't want to contradict, because it was not an academic setting. I was giving a talk, and these were my hosts. And I'm not going to contradict my host. I just like, it's very, for me, you know, it's a matter of politeness. And I just went, uh-huh. It's just like the moon, all the vaccines. I don't know, like the state has been doing all sorts of giant achievements. And I was just like, and then when we have private industry, the state seems to be there too. Not always, but I don't know, Tesla, right?
I was just going to say, I imagine that particular person is supportive of Musk.
Right, exactly. And I was just like, so I didn't answer. I actually looked at one of the hosts, and I think he stood up and said, well, thank you very much, because he didn't want to put me in the position of having to contradict a host who was a very important person. But I was like, wow, that's a belief that people have. And I'm just like, I know a lot of people that have that belief. And I'm just like, okay, show it to me, prove it. Give me some examples, because I don't know any. I know people that own businesses and they're just like, God, get the state out of my hair. They are hindering me. And I'm with them. I've been involved in business transactions where I'm like, yes, absolutely. I've been in actually one of my only business transactions was actually in France. And I had to deal with the French state. And I was like, this is a really hard place to make money. But what I was stunned how much the law has protected poor people, though. And I was like, that's really interesting. Like, if I didn't have any money, there were points in my life where I had no money. I was like, I would like this state looking after me. Right now, I'm trying to make a quick buck, and they're not making it so easy. So I won't be investing here again, because I needed to make a quick buck. Just judge me for it as you will. I didn't make as much as I wanted, but you know.
It's kind of reminiscent of the debate that after Obama during his 2012 reelection said, you didn't build that, which I think was extremely poorly worded and his messaging was bad. But he was speaking to something that is real, which is that we all pay into the infrastructure that makes possible. And if you have anarchy, you likely don't have a business. And if you don't want anarchy, that means the state is doing something good sort of necessarily. So, right.
Well, you're back to eminent domain. Who uses... So that was really a bad way of saying it, okay? And Obama was often remarkable with words, and in a few cases, he really wasn't. And that's the hard part of that job, right? Is that one word off or something, and you know, it's such an amplified thing. And by the way, even as an author, I get terrified. I'm terrified, you know, people listening to what I say about postmodernism, because I want to be fair to everybody, okay? I don't want to be reductionist. But in Los Angeles, we're having all these discussions because what we're seeing, someone like myself, I mean, I live in the hills. I live this ridiculously nice life. I work really, really hard, but the whole infrastructure that does work is built for me. Now, I pay a fair amount of taxes here, but there are other people that pay taxes that get literally nothing for it. We don't really have a functioning public transportation system. It's 100 degrees out there. I don't know if you can imagine taking a bus across LA, which is, you know, bigger than Belgium, basically. You know, if you don't have a car in this town this weekend, you're in trouble. It's going to be 110 degrees. If you don't have a car with air conditioning, there's a whole infrastructure here that everyone has paid for that definitely is benefiting a few people. Now, some of these people are incredibly productive. It does beg the question, if that is that production benefiting everybody? In LA, we know we have terrible wealth distribution. We have terrible poverty. At this point, we have rich people and poor people. There's almost no one in between. Mm-hmm. That's not a healthy place to be. By the way, people say, oh, California, California. Well, that was because the market did that. People still stay here and pay the taxes. The market has done some crazy things, especially with housing. And private companies are some of the reasons we don't have a public transportation system. We did, by the way. This was the city of the Dodgers. You know what the Dodgers were? They were dodged in between tramways. They don't have any tramways anymore. So that was like literally the definition of an Angelino in the 1920s, was someone who dodged between tramways. Isn't that crazy? Oh, it's like a joke.
Union Station in LA, if people, I mean, nobody takes the trains to and from LA, but it is just this gorgeous, they actually did the Oscars there a couple of years ago. I mean, it's such a beautiful architectural.
Super beautiful.
But yeah, I just before today, earlier today typed a podcast on PG&E, the history of PG&E, and it's, you know, markets with a healthy assist from crony capitalists have not done a lot for California.
I'm really worried about blackouts. I just recharged one of my generators and I need to buy a giant generator because I don't like blackouts. Freak me out. They just freak me out. But anyway, you know, these are not easy questions. And I'm not saying we should have some state oversight of everything and that the state should be involved with everything and only good stuff comes from the state. Far from it. I will actually say this openly. I believe deeply in public education. I'm at a public, private university because they allowed me incredible entrepreneurialism. They didn't do it for everybody at the university, but that was the deal that I got. I got an unbelievable deal from the University of Southern California to try and do transformational work. And I was able to do it in a way that would be very hard at many public universities. I'm not sure it's so hard at a place like UCLA, but at other places. And I don't like dealing with bureaucracy, but I study bureaucracy. And so I'm kind of fascinated by it because I hate it. I'm like, I hate bureaucracy, but I don't just hate public bureaucracy. By the way, I know it's necessary. I want it to be done well. And there are times in LA, I'm amazed when the bureaucracy works as well as it does. I make a phone call and something happens in like 8 hours. I'm like, that's incredible. More of that, right? Mm. One of the things I also don't like is private bureaucracy. I'll say this openly. Companies like McKinsey, I have a load of friends that work for these companies.
Yeah.
I often admire the work that you do, but it's often just, I think it's rent-seeking, just like conservative philosophers talked about public bureaucrats. I think that private bureaucrats can do much the same thing. They could just suck off the labor of other people. Mm-hmm. And we need to think about that. And so I don't think there's one answer. I think that's what my book shows. I think it's super complicated. We've lost that. Also, I do want to note, we really like what I call easy to read books, books that you can read quick, CEO books, you know, like answers for tomorrow, seven answers for the questions of tomorrow or something like that. I don't know. You know, I don't know what they're all the same and they're super easy. Like, make sure you tie your shoes. And I'm like, oh God, really? Seriously? You need to work hard and value your employees. I'm like, what? Come on, tell me something I don't know. I tried to say, look, free market thought is super complicated. It's super ancient. It is part of what we've been doing for so long. And it's not an easy shot. It's not just like, I want less government. Well, you might want that, but you have to think about what that means, if it's possible, and what your relationship to the government actually is.
Mm. Yeah. No, I was going to say the book ends on that exact note, basically.
So I'm not saying I have the answers. What I'm saying is we need to, I think my answer is we need to think about things and accept human complexity, that it's really, there aren't easy answers. And when we look for them, we don't do so well. I think we've become less sophisticated. By the way, it's great that there, I mean, I'm not saying my book is the greatest, but reading serious, hard books by people who do really hard scholarship. I spent 8 years on this book and it's based on work I've been doing for 20 years. I wanted to put everything into this book so that even if you disagree with some of it, you would say, look, this guy did the work. This is crazy. And I can see that there's some value in this book, because I think too many books are opinion pieces. So there's some opinion in my book, which you can ignore, you can disagree with, but go into the scholarship, prove me wrong. And I'm sure you can in many cases, but in other cases, it's going to be you might take you 8 years.
Well, it's a very enjoyable read. The book is Free Market, The History of an Idea. It's out on September 6th. Jacob Saul, thank you so much. You've been so generous with your time. Thank you so much for stopping by the show.
Well, thank you. It was a great discussion, and thanks for the deep read and the hard questions. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. I recommend all the listeners here check out the book. It's very, very interesting. I think you'll be just as interested in it as I was. Kind of hard to put down. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at The Federalist. We will be back soon with more. Until then, be lovers of freedom and anxious for the fray. Darling, you got me right where you are.